Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. You know who really likes Congress these days? Nobody. Well, not exactly nobody, but according to a recent Real Clear Politics poll, congressional approval is at 18% and disapproval at 71%. The approval rating has gone up and down a few points for years, but ever since about mid-2011, there was only one time it went above 20%. Maybe Americans are more polarized than ever. Maybe they just don't trust the government as much. And maybe there are also fewer standout members of Congress, people who advocate for original problem-solving ideas, even though they're sometimes controversial. One person who embodied those ideals for most of his career, at least according to this new documentary, was Daniel Patrick Moynihan. Moynihan once said, "Politics is an argument about the future." The four-term senator served in and out of government for 40 years, worked in the cabinets of four presidents, two Democrats and two Republicans. He advocated in Congress for big infrastructure projects, racial equality, and bipartisanship. As we all know, Patrick Moynihan died in 2003. There's a new documentary about him. Joseph Dorman and Toby Pearl Freilich's documentary Moynihan premieres at the Film Forum on Wednesday, October 3rd. So glad that you were in studio with us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. You know what? We want to make this a call out as well. What do you remember and what do you miss about Senator Moynihan? And for those of you who found him controversial, we'd like you to weigh in too. And is there anyone you see as Moynihan's heir apparent carrying on his tradition? Or maybe you worked with the man. Please give us a call. 212-433-9692. 212-433-WNYC. Joseph and Toby. Joe, what brought you to this project?
Well, it's interesting. Maura Moynihan, the senator's daughter, was very interested in making a film about her father's legacy. She felt a new generation really needed to know about him. And so she approached Toby and myself, and we were thrilled to do it. I was excited because about 20 years ago, I had made a film called Arguing the World about the New York intellectual group who were very close friends of his, also ideas men. So it was a natural for me, and Toby, I'll let you say.
Yeah, I had worked in city politics in some form in that I worked for David Garth. We did campaigns. We worked for Ed Koch. In fact, Moynihan had recorded some endorsement commercials for us. And the film I did right before this was a film about Israel's kibbutz movement. So I was certainly interested in poverty and distributive justice issues.
So it felt like a good fit.
Definitely.
It's interesting. I can get this later in the conversation, but I want to pick up on it because you mentioned it now. You described him as an ideas man. Mm. What does that mean?
Well, I think, you know, when you were mentioning that Moynihan was a perhaps a politician from a different generation, a more bipartisan generation, I think that's true. But even beyond that, he's kind of sui generis. I mean, he's more than once in a generation politician. He was a polymath. He was an intellectual. He was someone who thought on an incredibly large level. He was thinking both on the micro level in terms of statistics and numbers and how to make policy work, but he also had this very broad vision of the idea of how a democracy should work. And that was part of the way he saw architecture as important to democracy as well as policy making. So he was really, I mean, as someone says in the film, and I don't think this is untrue, he really was somewhat like the founding fathers in that breadth of vision.
And in fact, that made it kind of challenging to find the focus for a film. A film needs a certain focus. And here is somebody who had such a broad agenda and who was such a protean thinker and as Joe said, was such a polymath. And how do you kind of condense all of that into a two-hour, less than two-hour film?
One of the great things you do is it's chronological. You get a sense of how things evolved. And, you know, he taught at Harvard. As you said, he was an ideas man, an intellectual. He came from humble beginnings, right? Tell us about where he grew up and a little bit how he grew up, Toby.
Well, he came from a kind of lower middle class family. He was born in Oklahoma City in 1927. When he was a baby, the family moved to New York City. And his father was rather talented. He worked in advertising and journalism. But at the height of the Depression in 1936, his father abandoned the family, which was not an unusual story in those days. And they went from sort of lower middle class security. They were plunged into poverty, and it was left to Moynihan's mother to struggle as best she could with three children. Moynihan was the eldest of the three, and I think a lot of people said there's a difference between being poor and being broke. And for most of Moynihan's life, what he felt, he was very acutely aware of that, of this sense of one minute you're secure and the next minute you're insecure. And I think it left an indelible impression upon him. I don't think he ever really got over it. And that kind of gave us the focus for the film, because it became the focus for his life's work, which was poverty. At the end of the film, his widow Liz says, you know, at the end of his life, he had a big gray box and he kept throwing things into it that he wanted to work on after he retired. And when she looked at in it after he died, it was all about poverty. Hmm. And the two things to remember about that is that there were two moments when he was focusing on poverty where there was tremendous prosperity in the country. One of those times was the 1950s and early 1960s, and the other was when Clinton was in power, and the budget was balanced and things were flush, and Clinton wanted to cut welfare, and he bitterly opposed it, and he really was working against the headwinds of his own party and wanting to oppose these welfare cuts, so he had an acute sense always of what it meant to be poor.
I want to pick up on that, but we have somebody on line four who worked with the senator. Hi, Marion from Maplewood.
Hi.
Hi, tell
How
us.
How are you?
Good. Tell us your story.
Hi, Marion.
Hi, Marion.
Hello. Thank you for having me. I interned for Senator Moynihan. I was an unpaid intern for Senator Moynihan when I was in high school for over a year in his New York City office in the mid-1980s. And I had the pleasure of meeting the senator on quite a few occasions.
Hmm. What were your impressions as an intern?
My impressions of Senator Moynihan are pretty big. I don't think we have anyone in the Senate right now who comes even close to what Daniel Patrick Moynihan was willing to do and willing to say in front of the Senate. Not only was he an advocate for social justice and for the least fortunate, but I still remember him getting up in front of the Senate during the Iran-Contra scandal and saying out loud that Reagan's administration was teeter-tottering on that scandal. I mean, he called it the way he said it. He was a straight shooter. He didn't take any BS. And he was willing to go against the party, too. I don't see anyone close to Senator Moynihan right now in the Senate. It's a huge loss, and I can only hope we'll see someone like that again in our lifetime.
Thank you so much for calling in, Marion.
You know, it's interesting what Marion was saying, because I think that when Moynihan got to the Senate, and this was after a career already, a very established career, he was, it was the first time he was his own boss, and he saw the Senate as this, what it is, the bully pulpit of the Republic. And so he wasn't interested just in legislating, although he was certainly interested in that as well. He was interested in using that to bring out those ideas we were talking about, not just to the populace at large, but to his fellow senators. So, people talk about the fact that other senators who today often, the minute someone gets up on the floor to talk, will walk out the door, run to the bathroom, would actually stay and listen to Moynihan. And so, as Marion was saying, he would use it often to bring out controversial or sharp ideas. So that's very much, I think, the kind of politician and statesman Moynihan was.
Joseph and Suffren. Hi, Joseph.
Hi.
What's your memory of Moynihan?
Oh, this one's easy. I remember he said that the Social Security surplus should be kept in a locked box and not invested in federal government treasury bonds. And I think history has proved him right.
Yeah.
Thank you, Joseph. What are some other things he was prescient about?
Well, one of the big things he was prescient about, among other things, was what would happen when the Soviet Union fell. Right. He was talking about the fall of the Soviet Union just at the moment that the Reagan arms buildup was happening. And at that moment, he, by reading statistics, specifically the mortality rates in the Soviet Union, he understood that something very dire was happening with that system. It was not able to support itself. And so he was talking about that, and a lot of people who he had been very close to, Norman Podhoretz and other neoconservative thinkers, there was a falling out over this because there was such a split on what was going to happen. And without taking sides completely here, Moynihan was really, in fact, very prescient about that, and also prescient about what would happen in the aftermath, which was the advent of all this ethnic conflict that we see today.
He predicted the fall of the Soviet Union in 1979, which was a good decade before it actually happened. And this went against what the CIA was advising at the time.
Yeah.
If you want to join our conversation about Daniel Patrick Moynihan, what do you remember? What do you miss? Maybe you had an encounter with the man. Please weigh in at 212-433-9692, 212-433-9692. I'm talking to Joseph Dorman and Toby Pearl Freilich, the writers, producers, and directors of the new documentary, Moynihan. It's premiering at the Film Forum on Wednesday. Today's Wednesday.
Today is Wednesday.
Let's go to Dina in Manhattan. Hi, Dina.
Oh, hi. Yeah, maybe his daughter can just correct me a little bit or give me some more clarity. But I remember Daniel Patrick Moynihan standing up in the United Nations when everyone else was against the state of Israel. And he was always a fair-minded person and politician. And I remember him. It was very important to the American Jewish community when nobody was doing that. And to me, he was always a very honest politician, which sadly we don't have today. And I really miss him a lot because I really think the younger generation could learn so much from him. And I wish them much success in their film.
All right. Thanks.
This is Toby Pearl Freilich. I'm not his daughter, but I am one of the producers of the film. And I actually do remember that moment very distinctly. Now, for Moynihan, words were very important. And he said words have meaning. And racism had a very particular meaning to him. And he said, and so it was very important for him that resolution not pass. Just a little sort of side issue. Chaim Herzog was the Israeli ambassador to the UN at the time, and Chaim Herzog had roots in Ireland. And so he got along famously with Moynihan because of those Irish roots. They'd get together and drink together, and they got along very well. And Moynihan came out of a different age, and he very much supported the State of Israel, and he had fought in World War II, or he had certainly enlisted. He had been enlisted in the army in World War II, and he was a supporter of the State of Israel, and he also was anti-Soviet. And he understood that the Zionism as racism resolution, as it was presented, was a Soviet maneuver to win over a lot of the newly independent states, that it was a sort of geopolitical, geostrategic maneuver, and it was at its base, it was an anti-American maneuver. And so he was incensed by it, and that's why, among other reasons, he fought so strongly against it.
You know, I just to add to that a little, it is the first moment in my life when I remember Moynihan personally. I remember that it was sort of the beginning of my political conscience. But the interesting thing about that moment is it endeared Moynihan to the Jewish community in New York and across the states. But by doing that, it helped elect him senator, despite the fact that this was a principled position. But it was also a moment where he stood up for the United States as well. And that really was part of a sea change in the culture of this country.
We're talking with Joseph Dorman and Toby Pearl Freilich. Their new documentary is Moynihan. More with them after the break, and we'll take your calls. Yeah. Welcome back to All of It. We're talking about the life and the legacy of the politician, statesman, diplomat, sociologist, former senator from New York, Daniel Patrick Moynihan. A new documentary by my guests, Joseph Dorman and Toby Pearl Freilich, considers Moynihan's life and efforts towards bipartisanship in juxtaposition with what's going on today when we think about that. You mentioned that words were important, Toby, Jim, but sometimes his words got him in trouble.
Yes.
I think a lot of people, when they think about Moynihan, they think about two words, benign neglect, which were in a report, which he, it was the idea is he was saying we needed to calm down when it talked about race relations, and he used benign neglect as a way to describe it, as well as the Moynihan report, which was leaked to the press and was very controversial. I'll let you pick it up from there.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's interesting about this is these are the two most controversial moments in his life and the two most searing for Moynihan himself, because there was a lot of, he was attacked roundly by many on the left, black and white, for racism. None of which was in fact true, but it was a very heated moment in history. And there is so much misunderstanding still about this. There was, as you point out, the Moynihan report about the black family, which happened in the Johnson administration. There was another moment in the Nixon administration, this memo on benign neglect. And often when you read about today, even now, people condemning Moynihan, they conflate the two into something that's neither one nor the other. But just very quickly, in the Johnson administration, when he was in fact trying to spur a jobs program by the Johnson administration during the beginnings of the Great Society and the War on Poverty, he thought the way to do that was to paint a graphic portrait of what was happening to the black family. And he saw what was happening as based not just on endemic long-term racism in this country, but long-term economic injustice and other economic factors that were really destroying the black family in his eyes.
Do you think,
do you
think that he was, we're going to play him defending his position. Do you think he was naive in the way he wrote that, or have a little bit not tuned in or tone deaf?
Okay. I would like to answer that. One of the people we interview in the film is James Patterson, who's a retired professor from Brown. In addition to writing an entire book about the Moynihan Report, James Patterson wrote an entire book about the year 1965. And that was the year that Moynihan wrote the Moynihan Report. Now, he started it on New Year's Day, 1965, and finished it at the end of March. And one of the points Patterson makes about 65 is that if you look at the first half of the year, it was really still part of the 50s. The whole mentality of 65 shifted somewhere close to the middle of the year, and it became what we now think of as the 60s. And certainly by the time the Moynihan Report was leaked, which was in August, right after the Watts riots. The Watts riots broke out August 11th, 1965. The landscape had completely shifted. And what we now think of as the 60s, with a heightened consciousness about race, a heightened consciousness about feminism, all of that exploded into the national consciousness. But that wasn't there when Moynihan was actually drafting his report.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was a moment, it was a fundamental shift, as Toby said, and it was a moment when the civil rights movement was becoming the black power movement. And it was no longer tenable for a white man to be talking about or analyzing black culture as it had been just a year or two earlier. And Moynihan was the unfortunate victim of that. Now, in fact, many civil rights leaders like Martin Luther King and Kenneth Clark and others were very supportive of the report, but young black radicals, for a lot of understandable cultural reasons, were very frustrated.
Well, let's listen to Moynihan defend the report and then also to Ta-Nehisi Coates analyzing it.
I think there may have been a misunderstanding. I was trying to show the unemployment statistics, which are so dull, and you've read so many of them, and you don't know what you may mean, and they're hard to believe, that unemployment nonetheless ended up with orphaned children, with abandoned mothers, with men living furtive lives without even an address. That unemployment had flesh and blood and it could bleed.
One of the reasons why Moynihan Report ended up blowing up in Moynihan's face is the document was never meant for public perusal. it is written in a very bombastic way. It was written to get the attention of politicians.
So those are two clips from your documentary.
Yeah. You know, one thing that's interesting is a close friend of mine who's a black single mother, when I mentioned the fact that I was working on a film about Moynihan, her hackles went up immediately. Mm-hmm. And I think it's Kara Walker, another black artist. You see continually references to the Moynihan Report.
Carrie Mae Weems, I think it is.
Oh, is it Carrie Mae Weems?
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's this anger because they're still under the impression that he was attacking single motherhood and thought single motherhood was a problem. And all that, once you read the report and understand, is absolutely not true. He was, as Toby pointed out, from a single mother himself. But this got tangled, and he very unfairly, he talked about the tangled pathology. He really got tangled up in a certain kind of American pathology.
Well, it's interesting if you read that whole paragraph, he sort of is talking about intersectionality before we knew what intersectionality was.
Absolutely.
In a way that you have to talk about institutional issues, and you have to talk about education, and you have to talk about segregation and housing, that all of this leads to the conclusion he came to, which may not be a conclusion everyone would come to, but that was his.
That's absolutely right. You know, I'm a defender. Obviously, we're a defender of Moynihan. It's interesting because, obviously, it's a report written in 65 and not everything is absolutely correct. But it's interesting because there are longitudinal studies are about what are now called fragile families. And he was not far off the mark. Not everything was right. But it was, nonetheless, it was untenable for a white man to say that at that moment, and the report itself was too complex to be digested by the popular press, and it really got him into trouble.
And really, also what he was trying to say, I mean, this was also at a moment when the civil rights movement was fighting for basic civil rights like the right to vote, and he was saying freedom isn't enough. And if there wasn't also going to be equality, that there would be no peace. And in that, he was quite prescient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's take caller four. Hi, Lisa.
Hello, how are you?
Lisa, your brother worked with Moynihan?
Yes, he did. My brother's name is Gray Maxwell. It was his
sure.
Yeah.
Oh,
we're big fans.
We know
big
Gray.
Fans
your brother's
of Gray.
Great.
Yeah.
Oh, well, my goodness. Okay, well, then I'll keep it brief. I'll just tell you a personal anecdote, which he may have shared with you. I think when he was, I don't know what it was he was working on, if it was a speech or a report or whatever, but he handed in this long-handed written out thing for Moynihan to look over, and he handed it back to him after some time. Patrick Moynihan handed it back to him after some time, and almost all of it was just X'd out. And at the very end, he just wrote on it Gray Eschew Bloviation. And so, anyhow, Gray, he has, I mean, that as his first job on the Hill has set the tone for him, and his devotion to public service, and his method of behaving both, just in terms of personally and in the Senate. And he is disheartened, but he does believe that we all will prevail. So.
Great.
Lisa, thank you so much for calling in.
Gray has a cameo in the film, actually.
Yes, he does. You know, it's interesting because Gray is part of the Moynihan alumni, group of alumni, and there were a substantial number of people who came through Moynihan's staff who went on to great things, and he's one of them. It's really kind of remarkable. There was a story about this a number of years ago, what happened to Moynihan alums.
What do you think legislatively was his biggest contribution?
I think that he did some amazing things around Social Security and the budget, reconciling the budget in the 80s. I think those are major legislative accomplishments. And I think far more than that are
infrastructure.
Infrastructure, right. Talk about that, Tobe.
Well, he has a famous piece of legislation called ICE-T. America had been focused on highways and just putting down pavement, and he kind of allowed a lot of that money to be used towards mass transportation, public art, He got America to look at transportation in a whole new way. And instead of just focusing it on rural areas and highways, also on urban areas, he had a very sort of different understanding of urban needs.
Well, I was, yeah, just to follow up on that a little, what's great about this is Moynihan gets to be the head of this committee. And as Toby was saying, there were all these tax dollars going to laying down roads and cement, whether we needed it or not. And when Moynihan got to be the head of this committee, none of his colleagues cared because they thought it was sort of, there's a certain amount of, patronage or jobs coming out of this, but it seemed boring. But what seemed boring, the idea of infrastructure, trains, all these things, railroads, all these things, public spaces to Moynihan, were actually about the Democratic Republic.
And how people came together.
Right, they were about public spaces. So something seemed trivial to someone else. Moynihan understood this. He was a great, great fan of architecture. He wrote the architecture guidelines for the U.S. that are still in place. So that's the kind of vision he was able to bring to things.
You know, when he came into the Senate in 1977, they changed the name of the Public Works Committee to the Environment. I think it was Environment and Public Works. And he objected to that because to him, public works were great things. Mm. He objected to it being called Environment.
And yeah. Before I let you go, you've led me to my last question. What do you think he would think about the train station down on 34th and 8th going to be named after him?
Yeah. Well, I think he'd be proud and probably a little embarrassed knowing Moynihan. But I think it's a great testament to who he was and his vision for New York and, and the idea of the large public work and what it says about us as a city and a country.
The name of the documentary is Moynihan. It premieres at the Film Forum today. Joseph Dorman and Toby Pearl Frelick, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
It's really great.
Thank
the calls were great, too.
Yeah, they were.
Thanks for the caller.
Thank you.
You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart, and now it's time for Living Here with Kate. It's when we carve out some time in the show to talk about the shared experience of being a New Yorker. All of it is about culture and the culture, and certainly living in New York is its own unique cultural experience. Kate Hines is the planning editor in WNYC's award-winning newsroom, and she joins us now. And who did you bring with you, Kate?
I brought Jim O'Grady, a fellow reporter here at the station, and I'm sorry to say a Mets fan, but something of a sports aficionado and a historian.
Yes, I've been told you're the station's unofficial sports guru.
Yeah, I'm going to try really hard during this segment, so maybe I'll be named the official sports guru at some point.
We'll talk to somebody about that. Get HR on the phone. Kate, this week you want to talk about baseball. What's happening?
Tonight at 8:08 p.m., the New York Yankees, the storied team from the Bronx, faces off against the Oakland Athletics in the American League wild card game. Game time is at 8:08 p.m. tonight. If the Yankees win, they get to advance to the next round of the playoffs. If they lose, they go home and lick their wounds and hope for next year.
Yeah, Kate, the A's have not blown a game after the seventh inning throughout the entire season, and they have hit the most home runs of any team on the road.
And they're doing the relief pitcher thing, right?
They have a very strong bullpen. That's the point.
Yeah, they're not starting a starter. They're starting a middle reliever, which is a bold move. And the Yankees, in an equally bold move, are starting Luis Severino, who's been a little rocky in the second half of the season and not someone that we would think would be given the ball, but hey, we're going to see how it goes.
Yeah, that was a great... I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question.
Yeah.
That was a great point. They're doing this very innovative thing of not having a starting pitcher, but just putting in however many pitchers it takes.
It's all that analytics data stuff you just get whoever can get the strikeout.
This game is going to be 5 hours long. And it's going to be especially grueling because last night's National League wildcard game was 5 hours long.
Yeah.
All right, buckle up, everybody. Jim, in this crowded New York sports market, somehow baseball feels special. Why is that?
It really is true. A little throwback info here. So it's accepted that the first professional baseball team that had uniforms and played by a standard set of rules was the New York Knickerbockers, who played in Manhattan before they moved in 1845 to Hoboken. So there's this long, glorious, rich history of baseball in New York City, more than any other place in America. It's been happening professionally in New York for at least 173 years. That's the first thing. The second thing is, so many of the sport's greatest characters, the Babe, Babe Ruth, the Bambino, Jolton Joe DiMaggio, the great Jackie Robinson, these were New York characters. These were larger-than-life figures, and they all played for years in New York City. And finally, every pro sport is very hard to get to the championship. The season is long, but there's nothing like baseball's 162 games. So tonight, for example, the Yankees and the A's are playing an elimination game. And this season in 2018 started with spring training in early February. And baseball is with you every day for most of the year. So if you like baseball and you care about baseball, this whole thing comes down to the drama of one game tonight.
Dun, dun, dun.
It's right. A nail biter, man.
Okay, you're a Bronx native, I'm told.
Yes.
That's true?
Yes, I am. I was born in the Bronx.
You lived in the Bronx for a while. Is Yankee Fever different in the Bronx than the rest of the city?
It kind of is, and it has to do with pride. I went to college in the Bronx for 4 years. Thank you very much, Kate Hines. And and it was at a time where you could literally go to the roof of your building and look out and see buildings burning, set on fire by their landlords for the insurance money. It was a downtime, to say the least, in the mm-hmm. Bronx. But it seemed like every year in October, you would see this other beautiful glowing light. From far away, you could see it. And it was Yankee Stadium during the playoffs and the World Series. And it was the one time of the year where it seemed like America looked at the Bronx for reasons of achievement, of athletic excellence. And it was because of the Yankees, who have been in the Bronx since 1923, and they remain in the Bronx. So I do think it is a particular point of pride for that place when the Yankees are in the playoffs.
I just want to mention one thing. Speaking of history and the Yankees, tonight the MTA is going to be running what we call the nostalgia train up to the Bronx, which means, you know, I'm trying to remember what time, 7 p.m. If you're standing on the 42nd Street Uptown 4 train platform, you can ride nonstop to Yankee Stadium on a train that's been in operation since 1917.
Well, that's pretty cool in and of itself.
It's really cool.
Festooned with banners.
Yep. People dress up.
Yeah.
I want to talk to you about the Mets before we go. We have to talk about the Mets.
Okay. Because?
Because of David Wright.
Yeah. What a story, this guy. So he comes up to the major leagues in 2012. And for Mets fans, at this time, Derek Jeter is already established as a star of New York City. And we think David Wright is going to be our Jeter. And he had all the traits. He was like this firm-jawed, power-hitting third baseman. He played the game with integrity and with heart and really hard, just like Jeter. And he played his entire career with one team, like Jeter. He played with the Mets, got the most hits out of any Mets player. But he only made it to the World Series once in 2015. He hit a home run in Game 3, but the Mets lost to the Kansas City Royals. And then comes this sort of like very melancholy dwindling of his career, because in his young 30s, he's beset by these horrible injuries, this narrowing of his spine and all these
stenosis,
operations, stenosis. He's trying desperately to get back on the field. He goes through shoulder, neck, back operations. And we're always hoping that he's going to return to this great form that he once had. And of course, it never happened. But on Saturday, he played his last game at Citi Field.
Let's hear a little bit from David Wright.
A salute to the fans. And the captain is heading off for one final time.
Aw, David Wright leaving the field the last time.
Yeah, I think the Mets have had three captains in their history, and he's been one of them. And so he'll always be beloved by Mets fans, but there'll always be this footnote in our minds about what might have been with this guy.
I'm going to ask you for predictions before I let you go about tonight. Kate?
My God, I want to say that the Yankees are going to win, but the bleeding ulcer in my duodenum fears otherwise. The A's are tough on the road, and it's tough.
But Kate, the Yankees are at home. They have the home field advantage. They're in the Bronx.
They do, and it's a really hard stadium to be the away team in. But
it is.
The Yankees are going to win. The Yankees are going to win, but it's going to be a grueling game, and it's going to come down to the wire.
I'm going to say the A's are going to overcome their curse of always losing the first round of the playoffs and just somehow squeak out a victory over the Yankees. Although I want the Yankees to win.
Yes.
Say why.
Because if the Yankees win on Friday, they face the Red Sox. And that every baseball fan in America yes. wants to see the Yankees play the Red Sox.
Including me.
It is professional sports' most long-standing and delightfully delicious rivalry.
All right, we shall see. And Kate, I have a present for you on our Instagram.
Oh, is it the Oakland A's throwback uniform?
No, it's last week. You wanted a picture of my dog. I put it on there as sort of like a palate cleanser after last week. So if anybody wants to see a picture of Rocco or anything else that's going on with All of It, it's at All of It WNYC. That is our Instagram and Twitter handle. Jim, Kate, thank you so much.
Thank you, Allison.
Coming up next, a consideration of the real Lolita. A new book looks at the life of Sally Horner, her two-year disappearance and how her story may have influenced Nabokov. We'll be right back. You're listening to All of It. Sally Horner was 11 years old in 1948 when on a dare she stole a notebook from a five and dime in her hometown of Camden, New Jersey. As she was leaving a store, a man named Frank LaSalle claimed to be an FBI agent and threatened to send her to jail. He coerced her to take a bus with him to Atlantic City, and from there, they embarked on a cross-country road trip that lasted almost 2 years until she was finally rescued. Unfortunately, 2 years after her rescue, Sally was killed in a car crash. In The Real Lolita, The Kidnapping of Sally Horner and the Novel That Scandalized the World, journalist, author, and editor Sarah Weinman examines the brief, tragic life of Sally Horner and looks at how it may have inspired Vladimir Nabokov's 1955 novel, Lolita. The Real Lolita is published by Echo, and I'm happy to welcome Sarah to the studio.
Thank you so much for having me.
So your background is as a crime writer. How did you come across Sally Horner's story?
So I was at a point when I just turned in a recent crime story that would eventually be published by the New York Times Magazine. So I was looking around for my next story, and being a child of the internet, as I like to joke, it was a late night. I was looking at a mix of websites. There was Wikipedia pages, there were Reddit threads, there were message boards related to crime stories. And somehow I tumbled down this rabbit hole, and it landed on this essay that was published in the Times Literary Supplement called What Happened to Sally Horner, by a Nabokov scholar who posited that Sally's kidnapping was not only included as a direct reference in Nabokov's novel Lolita, but it actually was more of an influence than anyone ever knew. So I read that, and I thought, had anyone reported out Sally's story as a piece of journalism? Were there people still alive to remember her? Were there newspaper articles and court documents that I could discover? It was long enough ago that I knew that it would be difficult, but it was recent enough that I felt confident that I could find people who remembered Sally along her cross-country nightmare. And so I set out to do that. First, it was a magazine piece. But as I was writing that, I realized I had so much more to discover and to report out and to research. And then that became my book.
Well, Sally's story was covered across the country. What was that coverage like? How was she depicted? I mean, we know how missing girl stories are reported now.
Yeah, I mean, initially the kidnapping was covered more locally when she was rescued. And to be clear, her cross-country journey took her from Camden to Atlantic City to Baltimore, then on to Dallas, and finally to San Jose, California.
Wow.
And so when she was rescued in March of 1950, the newspaper and media coverage was saturated, not just in the States, but all around the world. And so many of those media accounts did portray Sally with some degree of sympathy, but not all did. Sometimes she was referred to as a love slave or as a captive. Her weight was commented on, the fact that she looked more like a young woman at that point.
Yeah.
So there were just it was troublesome.
Sounds like it for sure. You were able to visit buildings and landmarks on that trek that you mentioned from Baltimore to Dallas, California. What can you tell us about how she was living and what she went through?
I mean, it varied. When she was in Atlantic City, she and her kidnapper, Frank LaSalle, were staying at a boarding house. When they moved on to Baltimore, they were staying at another boarding house. And in Dallas and San Jose, they were in trailer parks. And so what I found interesting visiting these locales is that these neighborhoods now are more socioeconomically blighted. The population demographics have changed. At the time, they were more white, middle-class enclaves. And now they're more poor and predominantly African-American. So it sort of became an unconscious chronicle of how America has changed in these places, mm-hmm. and not necessarily for the better. But it was also important to realize that the America of post-World War II, that we often prop up as being this time of greatness, in fact, had this incredibly dark belly coursing underneath.
How was Frank LaSalle able to travel for 2 years with this young woman, young girl?
It helped that he had already had tremendous experience using fake names. To my count, he used at least 20 aliases during his life.
I didn't realize it was that many. I knew there were a few. 20?
Yeah, I did a final count right before the book was published and realized it was that many and was kind of taken aback as well. And so he would, at that time, you didn't have national registries, and certainly there was no electronic databases in the same way. And so if police jurisdictions and cities weren't talking to one another, it was very easy to kind of blend in and disappear. And it also in enrolling Sally at Catholic schools, that was another way to sort of hide, that she didn't have to necessarily be tracked by public schools. So just he would change his name, he would change her name. And whenever there was a sense that law enforcement might be getting closer, that's when they were on the move.
And initially, her mother didn't necessarily report her as missing, right? And she grew up in difficult circumstances, Sally did.
Yeah, so Sally's mother, Ella, was a single mother. Sally's father had committed suicide a few years earlier. He had been violent and abusive. There was also an older sister who was about to give birth to her first child. And Ella had trouble keeping a job, and there were times when the electricity wouldn't be working because she hadn't paid the bill. And so she saw what she thought was this week-long vacation, this ruse that Sally was forced to tell. She saw that as something that she could not provide her daughter.
Let's back up. How Frank LaSalle got Sally to go with him.
So as you mentioned off the top, Sally wanted to join a girls' club. And on a dare, she was told, if you steal a 5-cent notebook from the local five and dime, we'll let you in. And she was 10 going on 11. She was just about to steal it when a hand gripped her arm. And that's when Frank LaSalle said, I am an FBI agent and you are under arrest. He was not an FBI agent. She was most definitely not under arrest. But Sally, being so young, believed him. She saw him as a figure of authority. He let her go then, but a few months later encountered her on her way home from school. So this time he upped the stakes and said, not only will I send you to the reform school, but if you don't go along with me, even more terrible things will happen. So here's the story you need to tell your mother. So she told that story that LaSalle was really the father of schoolmates, that they were supposed to go for a week away at Atlantic City. Ella bought it because, again, she thought that this was a week vacation that her daughter desperately needed. And a week passed, Sally wrote. She called home. She said she was having a good time. She didn't want to come back. There were things happening. They were going to go to the Ice Follies. Other things kept popping up. 6 weeks passed. And it was the end of July in 1948 when Ella received another letter from Sally saying they were on to Baltimore and she wasn't going to write anymore. And that's when something woke up inside Ella's mind and she realized that she needed to get law enforcement involved.
We're speaking with Sarah Weinman, the author of The Real Lolita, The Kidnapping of Sally Horner, and the novel that scandalized the world. Did you get any sense that because there was that lag in time, when he grabbed her arm at the store and he approached her again, that he was stalking her?
I think that's a really reasonable assumption to make, especially since when the initial meet happened, he was only 2 months removed from a prison sentence for the rape of 5 girls between the ages of 12 and 14. And that sentence was only a 2.5 to 5 year sentence. And originally he wasn't even going to serve the full time. He'd been paroled, but because he was already a career criminal, he violated parole through other charges and was sent back to prison. But even then he only served about 5 years all told. That's not a long time for multiple rapes of young girls.
When Sally returned and she was rescued, did she report that she had been sexually assaulted or raped?
So the only the only time that we have Sally's voice is a statement that she gave to the Santa Clara County Sheriff's Office, which was ultimately reprinted in the Camden newspaper. And originally, when she was asked if she was raped, she denied it. But then careful coaxing got the truth out. And so it was reported that she had been violated. It wasn't always necessarily as used the language of rape, but certainly, you know, forced to have relations or forced to have sex.
That language of the
time. Exactly.
And it did affect her life after, I mean, the ways we would normally think, but also the way that society viewed her. It's, you have to crank back and think what that was like compared to now. She would be embraced as a victim and supported, but that wasn't necessarily the case.
It's really interesting to contrast what happened to Sally Horner versus how we look at the likes of Elizabeth Smart or J.C. Dugard or the three women who are the so-called Cleveland Trio. And thanks to their books, I felt like I had more contemporary psychological insight into what Sally Horner was going through. But yes, when she came home, because of the time, it was 1950, we didn't have that vocabulary that we do now to understand that she had endured repeated abuse and trauma. So she went back to Camden, to the house where she'd grown up in, to the school where she had gone, to the same people who knew her before, and they viewed her as someone, instead of a victim, who had willingly surrendered her virginity to an older man, and this, therefore, was essentially slut-shaming. And so she didn't have a lot of friends. She was very lonely. She really only had that one friend in the last year of her life.
Because she didn't live, she lived to be, how old, 15?
Just 15, yeah.
What happened there?
So it was the summer of 1952, and she and her best friend, Carol Starts, although when I spoke with her, she was Carol Taylor, they went for a weekend in Wildwood, New Jersey, another shore town. And the girls had been working as waitresses in a nearby town and saved up their pennies and took the bus down. And then Sally made a fatal mistake. She met an older boy, and instead of going on the bus with Carol home, she decided to go in this boy's car, and he would drive her to his hometown, and she would allegedly catch the bus.
She spent all day with him. She was sweet on
him. Yeah, I mean, it was a romance in the making. But it ended in horrible circumstances. He got into a multi-car accident. He escaped with injuries, but she was killed instantly.
All right, so this is a tragic story, and you piece it together in such like I said, you're a crime writer in this sort of this interesting way. Let's start to talk about Nabokov.
Yes.
What makes you and others think that he based Lolita on Sally Horner?
So the reason that I posit that he drew a great deal of inspiration from Sally's kidnapping, rescue, and death in Lolita, in part because there's a line in the novel that directly references the kidnapping. It's when Humbert, the pedophile narrator of Lolita, it's very late in the novel, he's returned to the town where he first met Dolores Hayes, the girl who he would take away and repeatedly rape on the road. And the line he thinks is, had I done to Dolly, that's Dolores, had I done to Dolly what Frank LaSalle, a 50-year-old mechanic, had done to 11-year-old Sally Horner in 1948. So the fact that that line is there, and with one other exception, that's the only real crime that's directly referenced in Lolita, it feels like a flashing neon sign. And so as other scholars, but then I also found, there's a note card that's in Nabokov's archives in the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., which pretty much recopies a Wire story that he must have read in the New York Times on August 20th of 1952 about Sally Horner's death. So a lot of the details of that story are incorporated in Lolita, but there are enough other details that make me think that Nabokov must have at least been aware of Sally's rescue in 1950. Maybe he wasn't directly influenced then, but it's the kind of thing where if you see a name and then you see it again, something sticks.
So if someone has read Lolita and then reads your book, what do you hope that they are able to think and synthesize about Lolita after learning Sally's story?
The thing with Lolita is the way that it's told, readers are often seduced and manipulated by Humbert's language. And that was by design, because Nabokov wrote it in this way where Humbert is wholly unreliable. And so we're sort of carried along by the force of his story and the weight of his narrative, that it can be all too easy to forget that this is a story of a man who repeatedly rapes a young girl. And so the flashes that we get of her are only filtered through his experience. And since he's unreliable, how can we possibly trust what he's saying? So my hope is that we remember Sally's story alongside Lolita, that she is now in permanent conversation with the novel. And I want people to realize that this is one young girl who matters, and therefore all the young girls, all the women, all those who have suffered abuse and trauma also matter. And because we're at a critical point where we're reckoning with so much, especially in the past year, but then onward, that's what I hope.
Sarah Wyman is the author of The Real Lolita, The Kidnapping of Sally Horner, and the novel that scandalized the world. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
This is our show. Thank you so much for listening to all of it. And by the way, Jim O'Grady said David Wright has been playing with the Mets since 2012. They knew that wasn't right. He's actually been with the Mets since 2004. We'll see you tomorrow.